mobilize that.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Our deepest condolences to his family, his wife Patricia, his children Robert, Mary, and Michael, his grandchildren, and his great-granddaughter. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee will meet on Tuesday, June 20th at 5:30 p.m. via public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon lawmakers propose a billion-dollar commitment in the state budget for the interstate bridge replacement. A federal probe into Minneapolis policing prompts renewed calls for reform and civilian input. And advocates call on the FDA to crack down on illegal vape products. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 20th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon lawmakers propose tacking an extra $1 billion to the state budget for the I-5 bridge replacement project. State legislators are on a time crunch to finish the budget before the session ends June 25th. One of these budget bills is House Bill 5005. And it focuses on general obligation bonds that helps fund things like higher education programs and affordable housing development. Late Monday, a last-minute amendment was added that critics say gives a blank check to the interstate bridge replacement project. It allocates $250 million in general obligation bonds every 2 years through the end of the decade. By 2030, that amounts to $1 billion. The total price of the bridges is far beyond that price tag, around $7.5 billion. The cost will be split between Oregon, Washington, and federal match money. Critics fear that big spending on the bridge replacement program will mean less funding for other important programs in HB 5005, like higher ed and affordable housing. They also worry that too much money is going towards expanding the I-5 freeway rather than reducing climate impacts and increasing bus and tram options. Proponents say they need to pass the funding now in order to be eligible for federal matching funds. The fact that the entire billion would come from this fund alone is surprising to some. Governor Tina Kotek previously said she doesn't want to commit $1 billion in bonds for the interstate bridge. But if the amendment succeeds, Kotek may have no choice but to sign the bill since it includes a lot of other funding for her important priorities. A proposed plan from the Bureau of Land Management would protect more than 400,000 acres in southeastern Oregon. The plan is expected to be crucial for wildlife as well as farmland. Eric Tegedoff reports.
A newly released management plan for the Owyhee landscape in Oregon will bring greater protections for more than 400,000 acres of public land. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management's proposed Southeastern Oregon Resource Management Plan amendment has been 20 years in the making. It protects 400,000 acres for their wilderness value. Julie Weichel was a member of the Southeast Oregon Resource Advisory Council, which helped develop the plan. She says protections are critical for wildlife in the region.
With respect to climate change, it's going to be absolutely essential to have these big intact pieces of landscape in order for wildlife to figure out how to survive.
Weichel says the region is a crucial wildlife corridor and also important habitat for sage grouse. She says more needs to be done to protect the landscape, but calls the plan a major step forward. A 30-day period began on Friday when the plan was published for anyone who wants to protest it. Governor Tina Kotek's office has 60 days to review the plan. Founder and head of Friends of the Owyhee, Tim Davis, says the plan will help protect the Owyhee watershed, which in turn benefits agriculture.
The farmlands that rely on that watershed produces over a billion bags of onions annually. And there's 150,000 acres of farmland from that watershed, so it's pretty critical to keep that watershed healthy.
Davis says the proposed plan will play an important role in the region.
It's just one step to preserving this landscape for our future generations to enjoy and know that they have a healthy landscape in their backyard right here.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A long-awaited federal report looking into the practices of Minneapolis police following George Floyd's murder has been released. The findings are likely to renew calls for broader policing reforms. Civic engagement leaders say citizens have a role to play by taking advantage of certain platforms. Mike Moen has the details.
The Minneapolis Police Department is one step closer to a consent decree after a scathing federal report was issued late last week. Around Minnesota, residents have opportunities to speak up about how their local law enforcement agencies operate. The Department of Justice released its findings about the Minneapolis Department following a lengthy investigation prompted by the murder of George Floyd. The report notes patterns of excessive force and unlawful discrimination against Black and Native American people. Michelle Witte of the League of Women Voters in Minnesota says if people have questions about their own police departments, they should feel that they have the right to speak up.
It's really great to have the community input, not just at the time of tragedy, but also ongoingly, right, to build those relationships, to build that two-way street.
Witte says anyone can check to see if their department has a civilian oversight board like the one in Minneapolis. She says speaking up at city council or county commission meetings is another option. Oversight boards are sometimes criticized for not having enough influence or complicating reforms, but supporters contend they can be effective if structured properly. Witte says speaking up through these platforms allows people to open a line of communication with civic leaders, including law enforcement. She says just like the importance of voting, being part of community input helps local governments establish accountability.
Democracy is a team sport. We have our government officials serving us, but we as citizens are there. We elect them. We pay for their salaries. So we need to also be involved.
As for Minneapolis, it's expected to take years for the police department to implement reforms once all parties sign off on the plan being negotiated with the federal government. A number of other police departments around the country are under consent decrees, legally binding agreements that set the path for specific reforms. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
The Food and Drug Administration has taken action to crack down on the sale of unauthorized e-cigarettes. Experts say it's now time for enforceable action to keep youth safe. Alex Gonzalez has more in Arizona.
The Food and Drug Administration recently announced several actions in an effort to crack down on illegal flavored disposable vape products, which are popular among kids and teenagers. According to the Arizona Department of Health Services, 51% of Arizona high school students have tried electronic vaping products and adds that teens who do vape are nearly four times more likely to start smoking cigarettes. Former Director of National Drug Control Policy under President Donald Trump, Jim Carroll, says he's glad the current administration is taking steps to ban what he calls dangerous products.
Specifically, what we're seeing is disposable vaping pens being shipped directly from China to the U.S., targeting our children. These vaping pens contain dangerous contaminants, but what's really scary is we're also seeing them contain lethal fentanyl.
Carroll says while the federal government banned flavored vaping products 3 years ago, a loophole in federal regulation has allowed millions of vaping pens to stay on shelves. He commends the FDA for having closed the loophole, but is now calling on the administration to take what he calls enforceable action. addiction. Carroll says these products are cause for concern because they come from an area of China that he says is known to be associated with the fentanyl trade. He says the United States government issued the alert, but says the administration now needs to be motivating, funding, and supporting law enforcement at the border to stop disposable vaping pens from entering the country. He says the marketing behind these products entice youth.
All sorts of, you know, crazy names and crazy graphics to really attract kids. You know, calling something watermelon and cotton candy is really designed to attract our children who don't understand the dangers.
Carroll says it's telling that China, the country manufacturing the disposable flavored vapes, has prohibited the sale of these products to the general public. He says aggressive enforcement is the answer to save lives in the U.S. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
In an effort to combat increasingly catastrophic wildfire seasons, prescribed burns are being used in Washington state. The controlled fires provide a chance to bring back a natural way to maintain the landscape. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
Wildfire season has arrived in Washington state, but prescribed burns during other parts of the year could help reduce the impact of the most catastrophic fires. Sammy Chanel with the Nature Conservancy in Washington says large fires have become worse in recent decades and a greater risk to communities. However, she notes that fire also plays a vital role for the ecosystem.
By suppressing pretty much all fires, we've taken that component out of something that naturally maintained the landscape. And so prescribed fire is really just returning something that was historically here back to the landscape.
She says climate change has contributed to the increased threat from wildfires as well. But government agencies and conservation organizations are utilizing controlled burns more often across Washington. Chanel says these burn projects are changing people's perspective on fire. One example is in the central Washington town of Roslyn, where her organization has partnered with the city, state, and private landowners to collaborate on strategically placed burns. She says the goal is to create a buffer from wildfire around the community. Chanel notes people in Roslyn are getting used to having smoke present during prescribed fire season.
Instead of freaking out that there's smoke, they're now grateful and understanding that there's smoke in the air because they know what that means to the community. They know that it's increasing their resilience and minimizing the risk of a wildfire.
Chanel says there's an increased diversity in the types of landscapes where burns happen.
We're starting to do more burning on private lands, which is really exciting and really necessary for us to start tying some of these projects together across the state.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with thunderstorms behind us and an overnight low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and a warm-up with a high of 76. Today in history. In 1972, an 18-and-a-half-minute gap appears in the tape recording a conversation between President Nixon and his advisors on the arrest of his operatives who broke into the Watergate Hotel. The quote of the day is from American singer and songwriter Lionel Richie, who was born this day in 1949. Richie said, quote, "When your past calls, don't answer. It has nothing new to say." More than 1 million people have been dropped from Medicaid over the past couple of months. This appears to be an attempt by some states to limit healthcare coverage following the end of the coronavirus pandemic. About 1.5 million people have been removed from Medicaid in more than 24 states. Most of those people lost coverage because of incomplete paperwork. Florida has dropped several hundred thousand people, by far the highest number. Other states aggressively removing people include Arkansas, Idaho, Kansas, Nevada, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia. By its own count, Arkansas has dropped more than 140,000 people from Medicaid. State officials said they have tried to renew coverage automatically for as many people as possible and placed a special emphasis on reaching families with children. Even so, A 2021 state law requires the post-pandemic eligibility redeterminations to be completed in 6 months, and the state says it will continue to, quote, swiftly disenroll individuals who are no longer eligible, end quote. More than 93 million people nationwide were enrolled in Medicaid as of February, up almost one-third from the pre-pandemic total in January 2020. The number increased dramatically because federal law prohibited states from removing people from Medicaid during the health emergency in exchange for giving states more funding. Now that eligibility reviews have resumed, states have begun assessing their backlog of cases. Neighboring state Idaho continued to evaluate people's Medicaid eligibility during the pandemic, even though it didn't remove anyone. When the enrollment freeze ended in April, Idaho started processing those cases. Advocates fear that many households losing coverage may include children who are actually still eligible because their Medicaid covers children at higher income levels than their parents or guardians. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services predicted last year that more than half of those removed were still actually eligible. Some states haven't been able to complete all of the eligibility determinations that are due each month. Pennsylvania reported more than 100,000 incomplete cases in both April and May, and more than 10,000 cases also remained incomplete in Arizona, Arkansas, Indiana, Iowa, New Mexico, and Ohio. Representative Ayanna Pressley marks Juneteenth by reintroducing the People's Justice Guarantee with a focus on decarceration. More than 1 million Americans are dropped from Medicaid coverage, and advocates for low-income families press lawmakers to renew federal policies proven to reduce poverty. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Government has shown us time and time again that more often than not, it does not lead, it responds.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts says bold structural reform of America's legal system is long overdue. Pressley marked the Juneteenth federal holiday by reintroducing the People's Justice Guarantee, which she calls decarceration-focused legislation. The bill aims to increase restorative justice practices, prevent companies from profiting from people's detention, and invest in historically impacted communities. More than 1 million people have been dropped from Medicaid so far this year as states move to end pandemic-era health care coverage. Avanil Joseph of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says most people are losing coverage for failing to complete paperwork.
When you rush through processes like this, which is the largest shift in health insurance coverage since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, people will fall through the cracks.
Federal officials are encouraging state Medicaid agencies to delay procedural terminations for 1 month to better reach recipients. Meanwhile, hundreds of advocates for low-income families are in Washington, D.C. this week to demand elected officials address poverty. Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign says poverty is now the fourth leading cause of death in America, higher than homicide.
Yet every night on the TV, you see things about homicide, but nothing about policy death and policy murder.
Advocates are pressing lawmakers to renew policies proven to reduce poverty, including the child tax credit. Abortion providers in North Carolina have filed a federal lawsuit challenging several provisions of a state law banning most abortions. Providers say the provisions are intentionally confusing, but State Senate Leader Phil Berger says the goal of the ban is to protect women's health.
It's a common sense, reasonable approach to restricting second and third trimester abortions and addressing maternal and infant care.
The lawsuit comes 1 month after the Republican supermajority in the state's General Assembly overrode a veto from the governor. A federal appeals court has sided with commercial fishermen in New England who say proposed restrictions aimed at saving North Atlantic right whales could put them out of business. Maine lobsterman Kurt Brown says there have been zero documented entanglements in Maine lobster gear for 2 decades.
And zero documented mortalities of a right whale in Maine lobster gear ever.
The ruling could mean the federal government must create new rules to protect the whales. And a federal judge has ordered Canadian oil firm Enbridge to shut down a section of its pipeline crossing tribal land in Wisconsin. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa argued the pipeline is at risk of rupture. The ruling calls for a gradual shutdown within 3 years, along with $5 million in damages for trespassing. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says tribal governments are huge allies to clean energy and green technology. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says she considers tribal governments huge allies in the Biden administration's efforts to develop cleaner forms of energy and cut carbon dioxide emissions. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports on her visit to a Forest County Potawatomi property in Milwaukee.
The energy secretary viewed a solar farm and an energy-efficient data center, the Forest County Potawatomi, opened a decade ago. She also heard about efforts to renovate older buildings to reduce their carbon footprint. Then Granholm spoke to a group of children and tribal leaders.
So appreciate the emphasis on being one with this planet, with our land, our water, and our air.
Granholm told news reporters that she's trying to help President Biden get to his goal of 100% clean electricity by 2035 and net zero carbon pollution by 2050.
The tribal governments across the nation are huge allies for us in making that happen. They're sovereign governments, but they also can take advantage of some of the incentives that have been passed in this Invest in America agenda.
Forest County Potawatomi Vice Chairwoman Heather Van Zyl says that in a private meeting with tribal leaders, Granholm mentioned clean energy tax credits in the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act. Van Zyl says those credits are interesting and that the tribe has already applied for clean energy and conservation grants.
It's a long-standing importance to the tribe due to the fact that we as Anishinaabe people are all about preserving and protecting our land, our water, and our natural resources.
During Secretary Granholm's visit to Milwaukee, she also announced the release of $77 million to improve the nation's electrical grid in seven states. Tribes in Louisiana, California, and Connecticut will receive about $1.3 million of those funds. I'm Chuck Quernbach.
The governments of Canada and Ontario have reached a proposed settlement with 21 First Nations in Ontario. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it would be for $10 billion.
The Robinson-Huron Treaty Litigation Fund represents the 21 Robinson-Huron First Nations, mostly in northeastern Ontario along the shores of Lake Huron. The First Nations went to court more than 10 years ago, claiming governments failed to increase annuities payments as the resource revenue in the treaty territory increased. Instead, the parties met at the negotiating table to reach a proposed settlement.
Tears of joy, and my heart is lighter today.
That's Chief Dean Sayers of the Batchewana First Nation. He says under an 1850 treaty, the collective annuity to the First Nations from resource revenues should have increased as those revenues increased, but they were bumped only once in 1875 from $1.70 a person to $4 a person and didn't change since. Now the Ontario government and the Canadian government will each pay $5 billion. Sayers says now the First Nations will decide what's next and what to do with the money, and for that they will engage their members.
There will be community meetings, there will be individual interviews, questionnaires in regards to how we might move forward.
The new money for resource sharing and annuities will be negotiated after the compensation agreement is finalized. Other chiefs call the proposed deal a major milestone and a chance to renew the treaty relationship. When the settlement is approved, each of the 21 First Nations will get a share based on a distribution agreement. That agreement will not be final until approved by all parties and by the courts. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Trump's indictment is actually a matter of national security. It's not just about domestic politics. The classified information at stake had military plans and details about American vulnerabilities. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. I dedicate this commentary to the memory of my friend and former colleague, Daniel Ellsberg, who passed away Friday. He and I were among the authors of the top-secret Pentagon Papers, which Daniel released to the public in hopes of ending the Vietnam War. His powerful voice for peace will be greatly missed. The indictment of Donald J. Trump is a matter of national security, not just American politics. To read the many charges against Trump is to be reminded that there are real secrets of state. Maybe only 5% of all classified material, as Dan Ellsberg liked to say, but still documents that, in the wrong hands, can result in foreign policy disasters, loss of life, and threats to U.S. military and civilian personnel on duty. Presidents have access to current and prospective military operations, to the nuclear weapons codes, to ongoing spy operations, to intelligence assessments about foreign governments and their leaders, and to the latest weapons research. Trump took documents that fall within the 5% category. The federal indictment of Trump states, quote, the classified documents Trump stored in his boxes included information regarding defense and weapons capabilities of both the United States and foreign countries, United States nuclear programs, potential vulnerabilities of the U.S. and its allies to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation in response to a foreign attack. The unauthorized disclosure of these classified documents could put at risk the national security of the United States, foreign relations, the safety of the U.S. military, and human sources, and the continued viability of sensitive intelligence collection methods. Some documents had special markings that indicate extremely sensitive information beyond top secret, including the identity of U.S. spies and signal intelligence on foreign militaries. While in office, Trump had a reputation for playing fast and loose with the nation's secrets, as he once, and probably more than once, demonstrated during an Oval Office visit with Russian officials. Trump seemed more interested in showing off top-secret documents than protecting national security. As Elizabeth Newman, formerly Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism in Trump's Department of Homeland Security, recently said, quote, I found the indictment to be a really vivid picture for the American public of what the national security community dealt with for 4 years when he was president. He had a blatant disregard, just did not care to follow the rules. When top-secret special access programs, such as Trump took with him, when they fall into the wrong hands, she said, people die and the United States security is deeply compromised. Trump's behavior fits with his monumental ego, which leads him to believe he is smarter than everyone and is America's savior. As he said the day after his court appearance, I am the only one that can save this nation. As president, he showed utter disdain for the intelligence community, military leaders, and diplomats, and therefore for their secrets. The indictment of Trump mentions that on several occasions in 2021, Trump showed classified documents to people without security clearances, in each case stating that he knew he should not be doing so. The documents included plans of attack on another country, classified maps, and so on. This is the man who, as a candidate in 2016, said, we can't have someone in the Oval Office who doesn't understand the meaning of the word confidential or classified. The special prosecutor's indictment shows that Trump was careless about handling confidential documents and obstructionist in concealing them. His motives, however, are left open to speculation. Perhaps he was merely wanting the documents around to boast about his one-time control of the nation's most closely held secrets. Or perhaps he had visions of writing his memoirs. But it's also possible Trump planned to exploit the secrets for financial gain, selling intelligence to the highest bidder. Trump's allies in and out of Congress are desperately searching for arguments that can be used to exonerate him. Witch hunt is the tiresome mantra Trump and some of his followers use. Others, such as Congressman Jim Johnson, deploy the Presidential Records Act, which is not part of the indictment and which clearly does not give Trump the right to declassify anything, anytime. Still other supporters, such as Mike Pence and Senator Lindsey Graham, say Trump did a bad thing, but, with an eye to the MAGAites, insist his case is political, not judicial. The last things any of these sycophants wants to discuss are the implications for national security of what Trump did, or his motives. Republicans used to be famous for posing as guardians of national security, but now they bleefully dismiss the notion that Trump is a national security risk. None of their arguments, however, can relieve Trump's guilt. He is what he has been since 2016, a threat to national security. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 20th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast with this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Are consumers being lulled into believing that the animals we end up eating are being treated any better than in the past? Animal rights supporters say yes, and longtime animal rights activist Hope Bohannock's new book, The Humane Hoax, Essays Exposing the Myth of Happy Meat, Humane Dairy, and Ethical Eggs, attempts to explain what's really going on in the agriculture industry. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about what she found out in the course of her research for the book.
So the humane hoax, some people have called it humane washing, the humane myth, also greenwashing is part of this. And, you know, it's what we're seeing from the industry. There's a marketing shift, labeling, marketing of animal products that are saying that there's a better way, of course, to breed and raise and slaughter animals to produce food. But what I have found through extensive research for 20 years, I've been doing this research now for 20 years, actually going to the farms,